Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And I got banned from Facebook again.
Oh my God. Is it the same post?
No, different one. I mean, I guess maybe I should have learned my lesson. And especially, it feels like once you're banned once, they kind of flag you as a shit starter. Because like I'll post something, and I'll be like, this might get me banned. But it was in response to, so I posted, I'm so sorry that happened to you, men are trash. And it was in the response to a story that someone had posted in the Dickwads Be Gone group on Facebook. And if you read what this person posted, the only logical conclusion was men are trash. But apparently context and nuance are both dead now, so that's fine. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I think I talked about it on the last show. Like, there was a case where this one woman saw that Kamala Harris was being called a cunt on her Facebook page and reported it, and mm-hmm. nothing happened. But then I say men are trash in a private Facebook group.
Yeah.
And I get banned. And I understand that, you know, I know, Varsha, you love the term slippery slope. But I mean, I do understand, you know, even in private Facebook groups, like, do we want Nazis to have private Facebook groups where they can, like, spread their hate? But I feel like, again, context is important. And also when you're talking about power dynamics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like in comedy, it's all about punching up. It's all about, you know, speaking truth to power. And you have to take into account the existing power structures.
Yeah. I listened to a recent podcast about the content, like, reviewers on Facebook and how they work, like how their lives are, and their lives are horrible. So it's not like I envy their job at all.
No.
Nor do I think I can do that job better, because there's like really, really horrific shit on the internet. Like, that's worse than men are trash or people calling Kamala Harris a cunt. Right. And so it is a real problem to try to understand how to edit and control the information that's going online, especially on these social media websites, because it's hard for them to even do that. But it's not as if we should cut them slack, because they should be trying to get better at it. And I feel like they're not, especially when you look at this individual case.
Right. I mean, I feel like you could. My problem is that they could do things that don't involve, you know, making the lives of the people who have to do this job worse already.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like technologically there are things they could do that they just don't.
Yeah.
I'm kind of armchair punditing here, or armchair tech CEOing here, because like I don't know enough about how it works, mm-hmm. the intricacies of it. But at the same time, it's still just very frustrating. And it just makes so apparent the power divides that exist in these spaces.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I find it frustrating is not just because you personally are banned from Facebook, but like when you look at Twitter and Facebook in general, they do not do their job when it comes to banning Nazis, like actual fucking Nazis, right?
Exactly.
And actual fucking violent hate speech, which the thing is, they are allowed to get rid of. They're not the government. Right. That is the one thing that we do know, is that like Facebook and Twitter is not the government. So they're allowed to shut down stuff. Right. So like we're going to talk about the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand, and Reddit just recently shut down a bunch of its threads that had to do with violence and gore, and literally the r/watch people die thread, which exists apparently. Right. And so Reddit is doing a really good job of this. I mean, better than most, but Twitter and Facebook aren't, and it's really frustrating. And so it was like same thing with Google when it comes to YouTube. Like, the fucking shooting was live streamed on Facebook, and it was put on YouTube, and it's horrible.
I mean, I'm not annoyed on a First Amendment basis, I'm not even annoyed on my own behalf, because I mean, is men are trash a nice thing to say? No, not really. But I'm annoyed in a more general sense.
Yeah.
And I think it just speaks to larger things. But no, this is not a First Amendment issue. They are not suppressing my right to say what I want to say. It is a platform that they run. They can do what they want with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just at this point, it's just more funny. I get banned from Facebook kind of a lot, so it's, you know, not that big of a deal. But I'm back. But we have a lot to get to today, Varsha. So fucking much. We're going to start by talking about the 2020 race, because I swear to God, we opened that can of worms, and I knew that it was all we were going to talk about forever. So we're going to talk about 2020 race and a certain B word who has gotten into the race.
Wait,
it's not Bernie this time. We're also going to talk about Ilhan Omar and kind of the complexities of her statements and the Democratic Party and the dumpster fire in which we all live. Mm-hmm. And we are, as Varsha mentioned, going to talk about New Zealand and the shooting that happened there. It was today. It was in New Zealand, so it was technically last night for us or this morning.
Yeah.
But yes, that happened today. So packed, packed show. So let's jump right in. Okay, Varsha, which new B word is joining the 2020 Democratic race?
It's Beto O'Rourke. Woo!
Oh my God. I'm so over this guy.
It's so weird how I have gone from really liking this person to really disliking him. And it really is, and I tweeted about it last night, it really is because I hated Ted Cruz that much. I really hated Ted Cruz, like, with a burning passion.
And the thing is like, Beto himself as a politician, as a senator, as a congressman is fine. But the way that he's gotten into the 2020 Democratic slate is what's annoying me.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, Varsha. I think our hatred for Ted Cruz sort of obfuscated the sort of more grating aspects of Beto's personality. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't feel bad talking about his likability here, because since this is going to obviously be a very important narrative because of all the women that are running. Mm-hmm. So let's just go ahead and like lean right into it.
Yeah. So so he announces, right? And he announces like any fucking TV politician would announce, with his wife sitting next to him in front of a camera, like on their couch. And his wife was just quiet during this whole announcement. I'm like, why the fuck is she next to you?
She had this like simpering like adulation on her face. Yeah. And I was like, come on.
And I'm not judging her at all or judging whatever this is, but I'm just like, do you not have an advisor who can tell you, hey, we're in 2019 after three really wide-ranging feminist movements and a lot of discussion about feminism in general and women's labor and women, and after Me Too. Do you think it's weird to have my wife sit next to me just sitting quietly staring at me while I tell the country about running for president? Like, does that seem okay to you?
No,
and
right.
It shouldn't seem okay.
I'm judging the situation and the way that he did it, because I found it very irritating.
Yeah. And then he made this joke. It was at a speech in Iowa, and he said it again today, literally like 20 minutes before you record. He said he thanks his wife for like raising their kids, quote, sometimes with my help. What the fuck?
Okay.
And he gets laughed.
So here, I want to John to jump on that for a second, because I just want to talk about the genesis of Beto's run for president. So he ran for Senate in Texas and he lost to Ted Cruz. He lost to Ted Cruz, the Senate's most hated man. I'm pretty sure that Ted Cruz hates Ted Cruz. And I have at least one really good interview that suggests that Ted Cruz's wife isn't exactly a fan either. And he lost by a couple of points. It was a very thin margin, which is like a Texas win. And I get that. And I'm not criticizing him for losing his Senate race. However, I am now criticizing him for, after losing that Senate race, going on a 3-month road trip by himself to find himself in the style of Eat, Pray, Love, which, again, that on its face, I'm judging you, but more on a personal level,
yeah.
Right? More like you left your wife and three small children at home to go fuck off across the state of Texas. Like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. If anyone that was not a rich white guy did that, first of all, there's just no way for someone who's not a rich white man to do that. And second of all, they would be laughed off of the slate of candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was posting rambling, you know, stream of consciousness diary entries on fucking Facebook, you know, one to kind of this point about I'm helping to raise my kids is, you know, he was like, I called Amy, his wife, on the phone, and she was in the car with the three kids and she was a little distracted. And it's like, you think
she's raising
you, asshole?
Like, what the fuck? And okay, so like, I want to compare this to another senator who decided not to run for president, who I want to thank him so much for deciding not to run, but also because I genuinely like him. So Senator Sherrod Brown, right? Like, he did his Dignity for Work campaign, but he legitimately like deep inside base politics, baseball people probably knew that he was doing it to see if he should run for president. But the campaign itself, like this Dignity for Work thing, was just talking to workers and learning about labor issues and telling people about his policies and changing the language around labor and what it means to have the dignity to work, right? And it was a good thing. I think it was good because that's sort of how Obama started his campaign way back way in like 2007, right, for president. And it was a good thing because what he was doing was just talking to voters and people and American people and actually trying to relate and learn about how he would change policy around labor issues. But Beto, his like start to the campaign was very like self-centered. And I get that you have to be a narcissist to run for president. Every single person running for president is a narcissist on different degrees.
Yep.
But this was like on another level. And it's so frustrating. And I really want to like deep dig down into the fact that because he ran against Ted Cruz, I did not really pay attention to his voting record. And I found out recently, and I knew this during the Senate campaign, but I was like, I like waved it off. But like a couple times ago when Tim Ryan was trying to challenge Nancy Pelosi, he voted with Tim Ryan to do so. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, again, you can't judge a person on just one vote, but I am. I'm going to do it. I'm going to fucking do it.
I'm actually, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do it. Well, here's the thing. I mean, but that is the thing. And when we looked at him as a candidate for Senate, it was a different sort of package of information that was important to us. Right. And now that we have to broaden it and open it up a little bit, we do get to judge him on those votes that he made. And it's not just that one that he made that I take issue with. And like you, I really like how you put that. It was so narcissistic. It was such a self-centered start to this campaign. And I also like Senator Brown. And I think, and I don't know, him personally, but I have a feeling that he kind of read the room here a little bit and said, you know what? This isn't my moment. Maybe I really want to. Maybe I really have some great ideas. Maybe I could do it. But this isn't the time. This isn't the moment. And that, to me, is the like the most – the least political thing he could have done in a great way. And so, I mean, I think my thing with Beto is that people – I don't know. I can't exactly put my finger on it. I can't exactly put my finger on why it is that it annoys me so much that he is just coming in and I don't know.
Yeah. And so another vote that he did, or it wasn't really a vote, but like he was running all across Texas, right? And so it was Gina Ortiz Jones was running against Will Hurd, right? And he refused to endorse Ortiz Jones. And so like because he was friends with Will Hurd. And so like I'm leading into this because the reason I think people like him, which whatever, like go ahead, is because he like is like this Kennedy-esque like younger Biden guy, basically. Like he is like normie politics in a bag because his announcement and what he's been talking about since then is about like unifying the country. And the thing is, yeah, we need a person who literally will embody Hillary Clinton's stronger together, because that is true. That is what we do. But unifying the country specifically around what type of policy, unifying the country specifically against what type of hate, right? If you're going to be the person who can't endorse a Democrat because you're friends with a Republican, is that really the kind of fighter we need in 2020 in the White House? Right. Like, is that really that type of fighter? Because like, Joe Biden was also making this joke a couple weeks ago about how everybody jumped on him for like praising Vice President Pence, right? And yeah, we should jump on you for praising Vice President Pence because Vice President Pence sucks. He's an asshole. Yeah. Just because he's a fellow VP doesn't mean you got to be friends with him. Doesn't mean you got to praise him. He's not like – and so the reason that I'm frustrated with people like Beto or Biden running is because they represent this type of politics that's very old hat. And for all of the flaws of Senator Sanders and all of the flaws of like every other 2020 candidate, they at least know that the fight is different this time around, right? And so I'm just going to be honest, like when Elizabeth Warren is talking, or Kirsten Gillibrand or Kamala Harris or even Sanders or even Cory Booker, they talk about it as like it's an existential threat that our values are being like challenged and destroyed, and we have to fight for that, and we have to be the kind of leader that fights against that. And I don't see that from Beto, especially when his announcement is not really about that. And then on top of that, he doesn't really have any fucking policy ideas yet. So.
Right. So I mean, as I've told everyone who's asked me about, you know, who I'm voting for, I'm like, look, we're not even finished getting candidates yet. Like, let's look at the whole, you know, fucking slate of like B-team Avengers that we have to look at and then decide. Yeah. But honestly, I think, I mean, as you're talking, and I think you're completely on the nose. You're all, as always, incisive and completely right. I mean, that's that, you know, that part of that like old guard. But you know what? What I hear though, when you say old guard, what I automatically put in was, we're back to this old boys club.
Yes.
And we're back to this idea that we need some sort of good looking Kennedy-esque, you know, white, rich, male, you know, the almost like avuncular or paternal Democrats, right? Where it's like the patriarch of the family, right? This good looking, strong man who will come in and save the day, and will do so with you in mind because he really cares about you. But it's really not, that's not centered in the campaign. Does that make sense? I guess I'm having a hard time.
It does. I feel like that's what it is about. And the thing is, other white dudes have declared for the presidency, right? Like, so Jay Inslee, he declared. And initially, I was annoyed. I was like, oh man, another white dude. Okay. But the thing is, he has a specific reason for running because he wants to put climate change front and center. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Pete Buttigieg, right? He's running South Bend, Indiana mayor, right? He has not a great chance to win the presidency, but he has a specific reason for running. It's because he's so young. He says he understands the policies that we need to to fix the fuck ups of 2008 and the Iraq War and everything. And because he's a veteran, right? So like people who are running, who are white dudes, they at least have a fucking reason to run. And again, same thing with Sanders. For all of the flaws that we don't like Sanders, at least Sanders has like the one thing that he wants to fix. And so when people like identify him and they say, why are you running for president? Like he knows and we know, oh, he's running for president to fix the economy. Elizabeth Warren is running for president to help make sure the economy works for women, men, and people of all different races. Like Kamala Harris is running for president to not just fix the economy and fix climate change, but because she believes she can fight for people of like from all different areas, right? Kirsten Gillibrand, same reason. Like we know why they're running. We know what drives them besides their own underlying narcissism. And for Beto, it just seems like he was like, why not? I'm the flavor of the month right now. Let's do it.
Yeah, why don't I capitalize on this? Like raise my own profile. Yeah. And again, it just goes back to this it feels very patriarchal in like the classic definition of patriarchal. Yeah. Like the head of the family, like even the way he announced with his wife sitting there next to him, like looking up lovingly at him. It's like, I'm going to run this country like I run my family with a firm but gracious hand. Like that's what it feels like. It feels like Kennedy. And people are saying, oh, that's great. We need another Kennedy. And I'm saying, no, Kennedy choked hookers in the bathtub, which again is not in and of itself a bad thing. But like, let's just be very clear on what we did and did not know about Kennedy.
Yeah. Like, but same thing. Yeah, it's the same thing with Biden, right? This idea that Biden can like talk the talk against Donald Trump and like he's like he's super close to Obama and all this stuff, and I'm like, well, to be like totally clear, like Obama like fucked up a lot in his presidency, specifically on the politics, right? When it comes to like fighting against Republicans and getting his ideas done, like I love Obama, I really do, but when you are trying to elect a new person, you would think, you know, not just being a historian, but you would think as a human, you'd be like, let's learn from our past mistakes. And like, for all of like the like flaws of Obama, the benefits were that he was really charismatic and like really good orator. And I get that from Beto. I get it that people like him because he talks to them or whatever. But also this type of old school politics of like, we can just get in a room and hash out the compromise. Like that is a serious, like, that is seriously undermining the evilness that is Mitch McConnell. And that is seriously misunderstanding the urgency of so many policies that we have to enact today, right? And I feel like that's what you get from women candidates that you don't get from men, at least in this cycle, is when you look at Warren, Harris, and Gillibrand, you see this idea that they understand the urgency of climate policy, healthcare policy, student loan policy, economic policy, regulation. Like, they get the urgency because they bring something new to the table. And that's why diversity isn't just a fucking, like, how many ever letter word it is. It's an actual thing that matters.
Right.
And you don't get that from Beto, which was really annoying.
If in 8 years, you know, if we, because when we take back the White House, because I have absolute faith in my party mm-hmm. right now, because if I don't, I'll just break down into yeah. tears. But when we do and we get someone elected, so in 8 years, if Beto was then like, oh, okay, I've seen how this has worked for 8 years, I'm going to throw my hat into the ring. I'd probably be like, come, Beto, sit next to me. I have nice things to say yeah. about you. But right now, get the fuck out. Go back to Texas and take care of your fucking kids.
Yes. And okay, it's this. Okay. And the thing is, someone will be like, oh, but like, wouldn't you want Stacey Abrams to run? I'm like, you know what? Fuck yeah, I would. I really fucking would.
Yes.
And it is actually yes. totally different from Beto, because the thing is, if Stacey Abrams announced tomorrow that she was running, I bet you dollars, like I bet you all the money that I have, like all my fucking makeup collection, that she would run on voting rights. And that would prove to me that she right. has a reason to run. Like from like the right. from her history of running in Georgia and her history of seeing how voting rights is being suppressed across the country, that she has a reason to run. And you couldn't throw that whole experience shit at me, because she has the same experience as Beto or as fucking Pete Buttigieg, right. right? And so what frustrates me is that people are like throwing this what about at me when I say I don't like O'Rourke, if I don't like Biden or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but the thing is, like, at this point, because we haven't seen any debates yet, it's literally only been a couple of months, I'm allowed to be like super freewheeling. Right?
Exactly. Right. That's why I don't answer when people ask me who yeah. I'm voting for in the primary, because I'm like, I don't
yeah,
fucking know.
And a wild idea for listeners out here. It might seem really out of there, but maybe we should vote for people in the primary who we think would be a good president, not who we think can mystically beat Donald Trump. Like, whatever the armchair pundits in your families or friends are saying, or whatever the pundits on TV are saying, forget who you think can quote unquote beat Donald Trump. Just vote for people who support the policies you do. And that's maybe going to end up with like a bunch of people voting for like Warren or Gillibrand or Harris, or like, it's going to be super diverse, but it'll come down to having the best candidate possible in terms of policy.
Right.
Right? So forget this yeah. like idea that you can predict who is the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. That's a stupid thing to do right now.
Well, and I've said this before and I'll say it again. If you're asking the question who can beat Trump, you're asking the wrong fucking question. Not the question. The question is who accurately represents the Democratic Party, its ideals and its values, and who do you think has the best policy? Like you just said, I know it's a little bit bananas. It's a little bit out there, but I think we can yep. do this. Okay, Varsha, so can you take us through what has happened with Ilhan Omar and you know, kind of what's going on there and what she said and the reaction to
yeah. it. So basically, Ilhan Omar is a Democrat from Minnesota. She's on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, and she is really, really pro-Palestine, right, in the conflict. But she's basically really well-versed in how America has conducted its foreign policy with relation to Israel and other countries over the past like 30, 40, 50 years, right? She got a lot of like, she got a lot of attention after she was questioning Elliot Abrams for his policy, in Latin America, right? And his role in basically like fucking up Latin American countries. But recently, like it was a couple of weeks ago, she sent out this tweet, and this isn't the first time she's done it, but she sent out this tweet about like how AIPAC and Israel have like a lot of influence in our politics, in American politics, when it comes to how we deal with Palestine, right? She's basically trying to point out the financial clout of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. But the thing is, there is a way to do that without touching on tropes that are pretty anti-Semitic, because she literally said, I want to mm-hmm. talk about the political influence in this country that says it's okay to push for allegiance to a foreign country. Allegiance is the word that's really problematic there, because allegiance means that it's basically like an accusation of dual loyalty against against mm-hmm. Jewish people in this country. This idea that Jewish people, Jewish Americans, can't be real Americans because they have loyalty to Israel, right? And that's deeply, deeply problematic. And so that was my first opinion when I read this. I was like, this is a problematic trope, and she's done it a couple of times, and we should just say, and somebody on her staff or other people in the Democratic House should just talk to her about this and deal with this, right? But then, like, the right wing, specifically, like, Donald Trump and a bunch of people on, like, Fox, like, jumped on her for this and this idea that she was being super right. anti-Semitic. And then so then a bunch of left-wing people on Twitter and just in general were like, why the fuck are we letting the Republican Party, full of Nazis and racists, try to accuse, like, Ilhan Omar, the only, like, one of the few black right. Muslim leaders in our party of, like, anti-Semitism? And the thing is, so many things can be true at the same time. And that's where this controversy boils down to.
Okay, so this is kind of where I, like, for me, where I was coming from, because I agree with you. And I, you know, and I definitely think that she has said problematic things. And like you said, this worn trope of, you know, dual allegiances and all of that. But you can have more than one thing happen. You can have, she can be trying to make a statement mm-hmm. that is true while using these sort of tropes or language that is not appropriate and not helpful. And you can want to condemn her for that, as the Democratic mm-hmm. Party did. But we can't let Republicans drive this fucking bus.
Because they are the actual fucking racists, right? Because literally, like, because
exactly.
there was this one congressperson that was, I think it was Meadows or one of the two, Meadows or the other guy. And he was, yeah, Jordan, Meadows or Jordan. And like, so one of them were like, was really hammering in on Ilhan Omar and how she's being anti-Semitic and that's horrible. And I think like a week later, he tweeted about like Tom Steyer with a dollar sign in Steyer's last name. That's fucking anti-Semitic. Like, right. you can't have Donald Trump, who had like a fucking yeah. sheriff star, like a star on front of, on like a campaign logo, criticizing Hillary Clinton, tell you what's anti-Semitic and what's not anti-Semitic. You can't have Donald Trump, who literally could not condemn white nationalists after Charlottesville, or who literally Donald Trump's last campaign ad was telling us about the big influences of like the big banks and these people controlling the economy. Right? It was super fucking anti-Semitic. Right. Like he. He has been like lobbing anti-Semitic tropes and like literal, not even dog whistles, just fucking anti-Semitic shit for the past 3 years, right? So it's not that Ilhan Omar did not use anti-Semitic tropes. She did. It's not that she doesn't understand that. She does, and she has been changing it. And it's not that she is incorrect about the influence that AIPAC and Israel, right. Israeli politics has on Democratic and Republican decision-making, because it's true. But it's also true that most Democrats and most Americans believe in Israel's right to exist, because that's not a question here. And that's not the question. Right. The question here is Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, is pretty fucking corrupt. He's a pretty shitty guy, okay? He's doing some pretty shitty things, not just to Palestinians, but also to Israelis. Like, he's wrapped in controversy. And AIPAC, the lobbying group in the United States, also is pretty, pretty conservative and problematic in how they lobby. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Israel doesn't have a right to lobby, or Israeli people or Jewish people in the United States don't have a right to lobby. It's more that we should be understanding of how that works and whether or not we are making the right decisions here. And then somebody like,
well, so what I heard, mm-hmm. so for me, what I heard, you know, listening to what she said, you know, reading some analysis of it and trying to understand what it is she was saying, what I got from her initial statement, the first time I heard it and before reading analysis about it, what she was trying to say clumsily, and it probably in terms that she should not have used and should know better than to use, but she was saying that this sort of lobbying has outsized mm-hmm. influence on American politics, which yeah. is true. Whether or not Israel should exist never yeah. came up. It wasn't even a subtext. It wasn't even like a cousin of a subtext, which is why I'm having a hard time placing this in this larger debate of anti-Semitism yeah. in the United States.
It does make sense.
And I don't want to come off as wrong-hearted yeah. here. I just I'm not sure. Again, I'm not Jewish. I didn't grow up Jewish. I mean, my family is Jewish.
And I think the reason people are offended is because of that term allegiance, right? And the previous tweet, this was, I think, earlier in February, she was talking about, like, AIPAC and why, and somebody asked, why do you think, like, what is it about AIPAC? And she's like, it's all about the Benjamins. And that type of language is really, really problematic because of the historic association with Jewish people and their, like, need for money or whatever. And it was using anti-Semitic tropes without actually being anti-Semitic. And the reason you can know that it's not actually anti-Semitic is because she isn't actually anti-Semitic, right? And there are people who are actually Jewish, who are, like, smarter than me, who are pointing this out, right? But then what happened is that, you know, so, like, because Republicans were piling on her, especially in the House, they had Democrats, specifically Nancy Pelosi, had a resolution against hate, right? And that wasn't enough for Republicans, because then they were like, a bunch of Republicans actually voted against this, because the initial resolution was just against anti-Semitic resolutions, specifically condemning Ilhan Omar. And it didn't actually specifically point to Omar, but then it became really broad and became a general anti-hate resolution. And then the resolution passed, but 23 Republicans voted against it. And a lot of these Republicans were people who were just, like, bitching about Ilhan Omar, right? And so what bothers me about it is not that, because so many things can be true, right? It's not that Ilhan Omar didn't make a slight mistake here. It's not that Israeli politics and how we understand Israel-Palestine issues, like, shouldn't be reexamined. It's not that, like, Republicans aren't crazy racist and anti-Semitic all the fucking time. It's that we chose for, like, 2 weeks as Democrats to collectively pile on the one African-American Muslim leader in the Congress, like, one of the few people, right? And that I found really fucked up.
So on Fox News, Jeannie Pirro said, she said, quote, she's not getting this anti-Israel sentiment doctrine from the Democrat Party. So if it's not rooted in the party, where is she getting it from? Think about it. Omar wears a hijab, which according to the Quran tells women to cover so they won't get molested. Is her adherence to this Islamic doctrine indicative of her adherence to Sharia law, which in and of itself is antithetical to the United States Constitution? Fox News apologized for that. When you know when Fox News is apologizing for something, like, that shit is bananas. But and so that's definitely part of it, right? It's because this isn't just all this outcry about anti-Semitism and what she said. It's about who she is and how, you know, and attacking, you know, a black leader in the party. And I also want to read, it's pretty long, so please stick with me, but I want to read a thread from Shonda Prescott Weinstein, who's at IBJIWONJI, and I'll post this somewhere, but they said, quote, it's like Speaker Pelosi wants to offer proof that American politicians are expected to display allegiance to Israel. This was after they put the resolution on the floor. They continue. White Jews are really showing their colors on this issue, their allegiances, if you will. What happens to Ilhan Omar, of course, matters deeply, but no matter what comes next in her political career, she has done a magnificent job of putting the establishment's stance on compulsory allegiance to Israel on full display. The more they deny it, the more it shows. Jews are not the reason this compulsory allegiance exists or is enforced, but many Jews play a role in enlivening it and enforcing it, and Jews are certainly the shield excuse that is used to justify this compulsory alliance. The true anti-Semites in this conversation are the people who say an attack on Israel is automatically an attack on Jews, and who entangle demands for allegiance to Israel with the idea that it's a demand for allegiance to Jews. If you want to support American Jews, the number one thing you can do is smash white supremacy. White supremacy is the greatest threat to global Jewry, including American Jews. Another threat to American Jewry, the systematic exclusion of Jews of color from Jewish communities and the participation of white Jews in assimilist white supremacy. So the question is why? Why must American politicians show allegiance to Israel? They say it's about Jews, and I do think the specter of anti-Semitism is powerful, but I think a lot of it is this, Christian evangelical money. Mm-hmm. And they go on, quote, evangelical Christians make up the biggest pro-Israel bloc in the U.S. Support for Israel is stronger among, and U.S. support for Israel is stronger among American evangelicals than it is even among American Jews. This sure looks like dueling allegiance to me. And according to, quote, according to Bloomberg poll, almost 60% of evangelicals say the U.S. should support Israel, even if its interests diverge with American interests. So they go on, and it's a very, very long thread. It is fascinating and definitely worth the read. As someone who knows way more than this, is a Jew themselves, you know, definitely, you know, a Jew of color, definitely something worth reading. But basically what it comes down to is a lot of this is, yes, attacking Ilhan Omar for who she is, but then also kind of mixing up allegiance to Israel with anti-Semitism or mixing up allegiance to Israel as support for the Jews as a whole.
Yeah. And that's what's like really bothering me about this is this idea that specifically just because it's Israel, right, that we're not allowed to criticize how the Israeli government is conducting its policy, right? And that's what's really frustrating about this, because like somebody was like, oh, does Ilhan Omar criticize like Saudi Arabia because she's like Muslim, right? Like, would she? And she literally does. She's one of the biggest critics of Saudi Arabia's policy and U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia, because we're pretty friendly towards Saudi Arabia, right? And so that's what bothers me about this, is that you have people like Jeanine Pirro literally coming out and saying this Islamophobic thing, which is literally an attack and an accusation of quote unquote dual loyalty to another, like to her religion or to the United States. And that's fucked up. And so what I got from all of this is that we contain multitudes and a lot of things can be fucking true. And it is true that you have to tread carefully when you're talking about this stuff, specifically so you're not hurting your community and the Jewish community at large, right? But you also have to be willing to fight bravely for the rights of people who are asking for your help. And that is true of Palestine. And that is true of people in Israel who are Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. So I think that's what bothers me about this, is what got lost in the whole debate around all this, the whole hullabaloo. No one was fucking talking about Palestine. No one was talking about what Ilhan Omar was trying to get at.
Exactly. And no one was talking and no one jumped on the lobbying money in politics either, which is another thing that she was trying to bring up. Again, not great. She did not do it in a way that she did it in an anti-Semitic way. She did it in an anti-Semitic way, which she apologized for, which was condemned by the party. But we still didn't talk about it. I think what really upsets me here is that we let Republicans take the wheel on this.
Yeah.
And basically use Ilhan Omar as a lightning rod, saying she's anti-Semitic, she should go, she's terrible, overtly Islamophobic, saying the quiet part out loud bullshit. And yet the news hullabaloo around Charlottesville didn't last that long.
Yeah.
And literal Nazis and other people out there who are so racist and homophobic and sexist, who are literally running our country. And so this is just a really intense case of whataboutism.
Yeah.
And that's not to say it didn't start with something that was actually anti-Semitic. And I'm not trying to dismiss that as something that we should just dismiss. But it is no longer about that. And it has become about this huge whataboutism.
And that's what really bothers me. Because like for the whole period of this controversy, what I was trying to do was just listen to Jewish people in my timeline, and like in my feed and on Twitter. And they were all basically saying the same thing. That like, yeah, it was problematic what she said at first. But the piling on against her from the Republican Party is not based in this real deep-seated protection need to protect Jewish people. That's not why they were doing it. Right. They were doing it because it literally is, it was proving her point that the Israeli government, Israel politics has a real strong influence on how Republicans and Democrats think about Israeli policy, like U.S. foreign policy. And that's a problem. Right. You know, it's not like
their outrage was not about, it was not in support of the Jewish community. It was against Ilhan Omar.
That's the one sentence summary of that. That's basically what it is. And it was it was just so frustrating because I was just like, here's a woman who's doing her best to like fight for her district, really bring to light the problems in U.S. foreign policy that we've been grappling with for decades, right, from president to president to president. And instead of trying to give her resources to make sure that she can make a better point next time around or say it in a better way next time around, we're just going to fucking pile on her. And that fucking bothered me.
Right. Well, and then it also there's also this question of like, you know, okay, so she fucked up. Mm-hmm. And it was an anti-Semitic thing to say. Does she get no more chances? How many chances does Donald Trump get? How many chances does Tim Meadows get? How many? I mean,
Or Steve King
or David Duke. I mean, who has, you know, who keeps fucking running for office? I'm just saying, like, you can, if you say bad shit, is it over? Or is it only over if you're not a white
man? Yeah, because fucking Ralph Northam still fucking governor of Virginia, right? And
oh my God, he's still fucking governor of, excuse me, the Commonwealth of Virginia.
The Commonwealth of Virginia. And so because, like, what bothers me is that, like, yeah, that's – you hit the nail on the head. Literally, only if you're a white person do you get second chances here. And that – I think that that's what was bothering me, is that it's not that I think that, like, every single person who says anti-Semitic things deserves, like, as many chances as we give them. It's more that she is one of the few people who, like, recognized the problematic aspects of what she said and was willing to change, yeah, but also was continued to willing to fight for what she believed in, which is not a problematic thing. What she believes in is, like, the rights of, like, Palestinian people. And that's not a problematic thing to say, right? That's not a problematic thing to believe right. in. And so she was willing to learn from that. But all the other fucking white racists we have in the Republican and the Democratic Party aren't willing to do that. And they get as many chances as they fucking want.
All right, Varsha. So let's talk about what happened in New Zealand earlier today. Basically, from my understanding, there were a few gunmen who went and shot a couple of mosques in Church Christ and killed 49 people and put an additional 48 people in the mm-hmm. hospital. And they were self-avowed white supremacists. So can you kind of take us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So there were shootings at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, right? And one of them was conducted by a 28-year-old guy from Australia. And basically, as you just said, 49 people died. And they had this manifesto. And it was literally a racist manifesto online. And they also streamed live video of the attacks on Facebook. And it was taken down off Facebook, but not fast enough. And then it was put up on YouTube for a pretty long time, right? And in this manifesto, like, basically it cited Donald Trump as a source of inspiration.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And also there was, like, in the manifesto, it also, like, talked about people as invaders, right? Which is similar language to what Donald Trump uses. And basically, it was just so clear that this was not just, like, racially motivated, not just, like, racist, but also a terrorist attack against Muslim people, right? And I really want to make the point that it's not that all of these Muslim people in New Zealand are immigrants. I was really frustrated by seeing that online as, like, describing them as, like, immigrants or refugees, which, like, many might be, but they're also, like, native-born New Zealanders as well who are Muslim. Right. They're also European right. Muslims who live in New Zealand so they're all fucking New Zealanders, okay? And Prime Minister right. Jacinda Ardern made that point really, really clear. She was like, we condemn this hate. We really, really want to make clear that this type of hate is not welcome here. And the people who this was perpetrated against, they are welcome here, you know?
Right.
And another thing that happened is literally after this attack, hours after, she said, our gun laws will change. Now is the time. People will be seeking change, and I am committed to that. Because she points to the fact that these people, they had a gun license, and a gun license for two semi-automatic weapons, which means that you have to change the gun laws, because it must be really, really fucked up that a person with this much hatred was able to pass through the system and get legal access to these guns, right? And yeah. New Zealand fucking realizes that.
That was her first instinct, mm-hmm. was what she said, quote, while work is being done as to the chain of events that led to both the holding of this gun license, as you mentioned, and the possession of these weapons, I can tell you one thing right now, our gun laws will change. So, I mean, this is a horrific, horrific incident. For that to be the response from the prime minister, it really throws into sharp relief how fucked up our own system is. And it also really is fucked up because what Trump said about this, and I'm going to quote here, and I hate quoting Trump, he classified these as terrorism attacks and said, quote, "These are sacred places of worship that were turned into scenes of evil killing. We've all seen what went on. It's a horrible, horrible thing." And it's just, it's like he's able to have this empathy and compassion and this ability to call it terrorism when it happens anywhere but here.
Literally anywhere but here. Because like also he was asked about white nationalism as, is it a rising menace? And he literally said, "I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems." And so he literally said, he was also asked about the manifesto and he said, "I did not see it, but I think it's horrible and blah, 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 blah." And it's just horrible, disgraceful. That's all he can just say. Like he can feign empathy because I really don't think it's empathy because he gives a fuck because the people who were killed here were Muslim people or black and brown people. He really does not care. There's no way that he actually cares. And the way I know he doesn't care is because he's able to, because as the president, he got a briefing on this like the second it happened. You know, he knows so much more than we do in terms of intelligence and information, right? So like there are people in Homeland Security and all these agencies who are telling him day in, day out, probably for the past 2 years now, that white nationalism is a fucking problem, not just in the United States, but globally, right? It's definitely a security threat. It is a real national security threat, right? And so the fact that when he is asked about white nationalism, whether it's a problem, he can just say, he dismisses it as a small group of people that have like mental problems, that have serious problems. And that's a bad thing. And I think what really bothers me about this is like, I think it was fucking Dan Crenshaw, Republican House member, who was like, people who are using this Christchurch shooting to have backhanded comments at Republicans are the real problem here. I'm like, no, we're not. Because what we're doing is we're pointing out the Islamophobia is not just in New Zealand, it's global and it's at home too. And this Islamophobia is fucking bad and it will lead to violence because there are people out there who are like trolly racists and they think they can just troll racism. That's not a thing because trolling inevitably leads to violence. It will. You cannot ironically be racist. You cannot ironically want to kill people.
Well, there was a poster up at a Republican Party sponsored event that had a picture of the Twin Towers on fire.
Yeah,
and it said "Never forget." And then the next was a picture of Ilhan Omar, who we were just talking about, with the words "Proof that you've already forgotten." So this is not some insulated small group of people issue. Yeah. This is not something that just happens in New Zealand. This is not something that just happens. I mean, there was a shooting at a synagogue late last year. There, Charlottesville. There was a murder at a church. I mean, this is not just about one group of people. This is about white supremacy globally. And you're right, he knows so much more about this has to be a considered security threat. There's no way that it's not.
Yep. And I think that's what really frustrated me about it, about the U.S. response specifically from Donald Trump and also like a couple of other Republicans, is that they refuse to see this as like a systemic problem. It's something that like if you really believe like as a lot of like anti-Trump Republicans and a lot of people in general do, that the Republican Party should exist or can continue to exist and can survive this and can eliminate this type of hatred and can help solve problems and continue to be like a good influence in the United States, they got to fucking address this problem within their party because it's been simmering and evident for decades now. Okay. It is a decades long problem that begins not with Donald Trump. It doesn't begin with Donald Trump. It doesn't begin with George W. Bush. It doesn't begin with Steve King. It's been going on for decades. Right. And it only compounds itself when you bring in the fact, the Islamophobia since like for the past couple decades. The Islamophobia is like deep seated. But like the problem of white nationalism is not it's not a partisan issue. It's definitely like all across the United States, there are probably like a bunch of white nationalists somewhere who want to vote for Democrats for some reason. You know, there's, but what I'm like, the problem that I saw after this Christchurch shooting last night is that there are Republicans, specifically Republican legislators, who don't view white nationalism as a systemic problem that's plaguing not just the United States, not just the Republican Party, but globally, right? And that's because the people who are white nationalists, like David Duke and all these people, have common cause with the GOP. They just don't say it out loud.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, and it's just, it's a horrific, horrific situation. And I mean, you know, the gun laws in New Zealand are pretty strict already.
Yeah.
And it just really makes it obvious how fucked up it is in the United States. Yeah, I mean, and the fact that in this country in the last 2 years, we've seen, you know, huge mass shootings like that. And last year there was a shooting, you know, the Parkland mm-hmm. shooting at a school. I mean, it's just, I don't understand how we're not seeing this. And the thing is, we are seeing it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And we just don't care.
We literally don't care. And I think like what really also just like, it like just punched me in the gut was the Prime Minister of New Zealand saying like the gun laws will change and thinking about how
yeah.
it will take. It hasn't happened in the United States yet. And that was just so frustrating to me because Las Vegas shooting, that person injured 500 people, like 59 people were killed, yeah. like 49 people were killed in New Zealand and they want to end the shooting. But almost yeah. 60 people were killed in a Las Vegas shooting and 500 people were injured and nothing happened. We didn't even fucking ban bump stocks. That was like a thing that was going to happen and it didn't actually happen. It's like policy now, but it's not actually banned, right? We can't even get our Congress to approve studying gun violence as a disease, like as a public policy problem by the CDC, right? Like we can't even get that approved, right? And so I think we were talking about lobbying and Israel earlier, right? And this is why, like, it's so important not to, like, shut up people like Ilhan Omar and other Democrats who are talking about the influence of lobbying in the United States, because the gun lobby is so effective at convincing Republicans that you will lose votes if you do not gut every single aspect of gun regulation in this country. And the only influence there that these politicians have, like these Republican politicians, is money. Because even though the NRA doesn't spend a lot of money, it's a lot of other people in Republican voters spend a lot of money, right? And so when I was like reading about this, it wasn't just like the thing that punched me in the gut was like this immense level of hatred that we have seen in the past few years against Muslims, but also the fact that other countries' leaders seem to understand the threat of white nationalism, seem to understand the threat of gun violence, seem to understand the threat of the patriarchy better than our leaders do, right? And it's just, it was so...
Better. Our leaders are in the fucking manifestos, yeah. For fuck's sake. Like, it's not even that we don't understand it. It's that we're literally, like, it's so far beyond... It's so far beyond us understanding it or even taking a position on it. It's gotten to the point where the terrorists in other countries are quoting our president.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to look at our life and our choices for a hot second, because that is some level of fucked up.
Yep. I think there was a quote. I forget. Let me quickly find it. One second. There was two quotes, one from the manifesto and one from the manifesto and one from Donald Trump. And see if you can tell me which quote is Donald Trump. So the first quote is, "We are experiencing an invasion on a level never seen before in history." The second quote is, "People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is." One is from Donald Trump, our fucking president, and one is from a document justifying a white supremacist terror attack, both made in the past 24 hours, let me just say.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, so, no. Which is which? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. This is a fun game. Just kidding. This is the worst game ever.
It's not a fun game. It's the second quote is Donald Trump. People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is. When he's talking about like Mexican immigrants coming up from the border, right?
Of course, is Donald Trump. It's it has worse grammar than the other one.
Right. And so like that's what really frustrates me. People who are supportive of Donald Trump, so like Republicans in the United States, they don't they don't see white nationalism as a systemic problem. They see racism as like just individual hatred, right? They see it as something that has to be in your heart. And that's not what it is. It is like a systemic, endemic thing. It's like it's a disease on our society. It literally is. And it spreads really, really fast because of the internet, because of the fact that you can live stream an Islamophobic attack, a terror attack, because you can have these communities online that are insulated, that are talking, that are saying the most horrific things and planning the most horrific things, right? You have to be really, really vigilant and willing to take a stand. And that's what Republicans aren't able to do. They refuse to do that. Okay, Devin, what are some action items people can do after listening to the show?
Okay, so for this week, please, please donate to your local chapter of Moms Demand Action Against Gun Violence. You don't have to be a mom. You don't have to... You don't have to be a woman. You don't have to be, you know, female identified in any way. But it is a great group. We've spoken with the founder, Shannon Watts, a couple of times, and they do a lot of really important work on gun control and gun violence on a state-by-state basis. So their whole strategy is that right this second, federal laws are sort of a non-starter. And so they're going state by state to make sure that they catch bad gun laws before they're passed and write new legislation to make sure that there is common sense gun reform. So definitely donate to them this week.
And another thing you can do, because of what happened in Christchurch, you could just check in with the Muslim people in your community, your friends, and a local mosque, and see if they need any help during this difficult time. Because I think that's one of the most heartbreaking things about what happened in New Zealand is a lot of mosques across the country and the area have to close down. And so Muslim people in that area don't even have like a place to turn to go yeah. through this. And so the same thing could happen in the United States, because we literally had a shooting at a synagogue a while ago, right? Yeah. And so just, you know, keep in touch with the Muslim and community in your area, and you know, see if they need any help.
So that is it for us. Thank you so much for listening, and Varsha, we will be back here next week. In the meantime, raise some hell, and please remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.